Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss America's horrendous legacy in Afghanistan. So, stay with us.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss a trail of US misdeeds in Afghanistan. And we shall also take a look at the motive behind launching the so-called War on Terror.
The withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan 2 decades after its unwanted arrival in the country left behind a nation grappling with uncertainty and turmoil. As we mark 2 years since its shameful exit from Afghan soil, it is imperative to remember the long list of human rights violations during its military presence in the country. While the West claimed that the so-called War on Terror brought stability in the country, the reality is otherwise. Civilian casualties, indiscriminate airstrikes, unlawful detentions, and other crimes against humanity form a part of the harrowing reality.
The Operation Enduring Freedom, led by the United States, was launched in 2001 under the pretext of dismantling the Taliban regime. However, the outcome has been marred by a grim legacy. Since 2001, an estimated 75,000 Afghan military and police personnel and more than 71,000 civilians have lost their lives. Reports reveal that NATO-led airstrikes resulted in the death of nearly 1,600 children just between 2016 and 2020. Unlawful detentions became another contentious issue, with tens of thousands held without charges or access to legal representation. According to reports, 70 to 90% of detainees were rounded up without proper evidence. Secret trials, based on questionable allegations, raised concern with no substantial action ever taken. According to human rights experts, the actions of the US government in Afghanistan were a failure, and the military occupation was not only the political hegemony of the United States, but also the hegemony of the West.
The US invasion of Afghanistan, falsely justified under the banner of counterterrorism, reveals a more complex narrative. While the pretext of America's longest war was to eradicate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, deeper motives that fueled the Afghan war are often overlooked. Buried lies a tale of strategic maneuvering, political interests, pursuit of the mineral wealth of Afghanistan, and the astonishing surge in opium production that unfolded in the aftermath of the US invasion.
Afghanistan's tumultuous history has been marked by decades of conflict, with the opium trade contributing to the violence in the region. Before the US invasion, the Taliban had banned opium production as it went against the laws of Islam. When the US-led invasion ousted the Taliban regime in the early 2000s, paradoxically, opium production surged, transforming Afghanistan into the world's largest producer, accounting for a startling 90% of global output. United Nations data shows a 35-fold increase in opium production since the US intervention, rising from 185 tons in 2001 to a staggering 6,400 tons in the recent years. While the official narrative claimed to fight terrorism, the US forces openly guarded poppy fields in the Afghan countryside and maintained connections with Afghan drug kingpins. According to some political observers, economic interests attracted America to Afghanistan and not the false rhetoric of cracking down on terrorist groups. Strategic relations experts say that the US invaded Afghanistan to loot its vast mineral wealth, including the huge lithium deposits, and to resurrect the poppy fields.
Minerals were one thing that the US was eyeing in Afghanistan or was greedy for in Afghanistan, it could have easily struck deal with whoever was in power in Kabul. That is what we are seeing now. The Chinese and other countries are rushing to Kabul to talk to the Taliban and get the rights to excavate, dig out minerals that are in abundance in Afghanistan. But I think the US did not go in for economic reasons. It went in for geo-security reasons to Afghanistan. As I said earlier, the aim was to make Soviet Union bleed. And I think everyone knows that it's because of the defeat of Soviet Union in Afghanistan that the whole Soviet Union then afterwards broke up.
Now let's talk about the women of Afghanistan. By omitting the history of the crimes committed by the NATO military alliance in Afghanistan, the United States has been trying to show itself as a rescuer of Afghan women. However, figures show the real picture. As per statistical data, after 20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan, various forms of violence against the Afghan women have increased. Experts say there has been an astronomical rise in cases of self-immolation, trafficking, prostitution, and kidnapping in the past 2 decades.
During the 2-decade occupation of Afghanistan, United States used Afghan women as a symbol to legitimate their bombing campaign in the country and also justify their war on terror, claiming that the so-called war on terror was also a fight to restore the rights and dignity of Afghan women. The Bush administration declared that the U.S. was able to liberate the Afghan women and guarantee them a rightful place in the society. Rejecting West's claim of women empowerment, Afghan women rights activists have been saying that the world has maintained a total silence over the atrocities committed against women during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Well, Afghan women sadly have been the most affected segment of the Afghan society over the last 20 or 40 years. And the problem is that they have not been seen as a sort of a very important segment of society, which nobody can win a war without the help or support of women in Afghanistan. And I think if you analytically look at the data as well, I'm not sure, but I think Afghan women widows would be one of the ratio of widow in Afghanistan would be one of the highest in the world, if not the top most. So Afghan women have, suffered not just because of the war, but of the economic situation on the ground as well. They have suffered poverty. They have suffered a lot of problems in the last 20 years. When the U.S. was waging a war in Afghanistan, the only aim it had was to achieve a military success in that area. And if it affected women or men or children, they didn't care about at that time. They did say on the surface that they are supporting them through NGOs and welfare funds. But I think that was very little amount that actually got to these women.
Experts say that the early expressions of support for Afghan women in the midst of U.S. military action served to paint a feminist glow on some of the most brutal bombings by America and its allies. Despite Western declaration of empowering the Afghan women, the female literacy rate in the country has not changed in the last 20 years. And the horrors the Afghan women suffered during the violent 2-decade U.S. occupation of the country still remain enshrouded in mystery.
We hardly get to hear about Afghan refugees in Western media and the severity of the Afghan refugee crisis. The humanitarian catastrophe brought by the 2 decades of U.S. occupation made millions of Afghans homeless. The destruction inflicted on civilians by the so-called war on terror has been incalculable. The figures given by the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, shows that at the end of 2020, there were around 2.8 million Afghan refugees worldwide, the vast majority of them in Iran and Pakistan. However, the actual number of displacements are probably twice the number.
Statistics show that at least 37 million people have fled their homes during the wars the U.S. military has launched since 2001. However, experts believe the total displaced by the U.S. post 9/11 wars could be closer to 48 to 59 million, as the international statistics generally count only the registered refugees. According to a 2020 research paper written by a joint research team from the U.S. universities of Boston and Brown, in 2015 there were almost as many unregistered Afghan refugees in Pakistan around 1.3 million, as there were registered refugees, which happens to be 1.5 million. Analysts say that this huge influx of refugees to the neighboring countries has led to socio-cultural, economic, and political effects in the host states, also putting pressure on their resources.
Well, it has been, of course, mishandled on a mammoth scale, for sure. Otherwise, we would not have been where we are today in Afghanistan. From day one, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the U.S. policy and its allies' policy vis-a-vis Afghanistan has been one of the failures after another one. We have seen that in the last two decades, they managed to bring in a system, a democratic system in Afghanistan on artificial basis that could not survive once they decided to leave. It fell apart the next day when the Americans left Afghanistan. The policy, if we are to assess Afghanistan's situation, we shouldn't be assessing it on the basis of the last 20 years. It should be, I think it's been more than 40 years that the US CIA and its allies like Pakistan have been trying to maneuver situation in Afghanistan, and they have not been successful in achieving what they wanted to achieve, a democratic Afghanistan.
As per experts, during the 20 years of its presence in Afghanistan, the United States played an essential role in breaking the Afghan society, leaving the people in desperate condition. The displacement caused by the U.S. war in Afghanistan has torn apart families, neighborhoods, communities, alongside other forms of wartime violence.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, the U.S. military withdrew from Afghanistan after 20 years of occupation. What has been the implications of this hasty withdrawal on the stability of the country, and also why the so quick withdrawal of the U.S. military forces?
Thank you for inviting me. Not say a hasty withdrawal. Because the U.S. and its NATO allies, they had already decided to leave Afghanistan because they were not successful. And they were the Taliban fighting against the foreign troops. They forced them to come to the negotiation table because the U.S. and the NATO allies were expecting that they would weaken the Taliban. And after the Taliban are weakened, they would go for the negotiation. But that approach was not, based on realities. So this was the American had in mind to leave Afghanistan. And you would know, the Taliban and Qatar and the U.S. A former ambassador to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Olson, for the first time in 2015. They started interaction, but the formal negotiation started in 2018. And so the American had a plan to leave Afghanistan because they did not achieve what they wanted to, because they want to finish the Taliban. They want to punish the Taliban. This was their claim. But Taliban were more stronger, and the American could not achieve their objectives. That's why they withdrew. So I would not say it was a hasty decision. But because they were not successful to defeat the Taliban,
Okay, so talking about Taliban, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, Afghanistan faced a rapid shift in power. What factors allowed the Taliban to regain control so swiftly?
Yes, I would say one factor was the division among the leaders in Afghanistan that time. Dr. Ashraf Ghani and Dr. Abdullah, they both took oath as president. So it never happened in anywhere. I don't think it happened anywhere in the world. So there was division within the political leadership. And I would say the Afghan National Army was tired, I would say. And they were under psychological stress when the Americans and the Taliban signed the agreement in 2020 on February 29. So that withdrawal agreement was a psychological pressure on the Afghan forces. The second factor was the people did not want more war because Taliban were fighting in villages, in rural areas, in mountains, and sometime on the road just to explode a bomb. But the people, there was no fighting in the cities. So the cities were safe. And that's why the people in, when the Taliban started controlling the provinces, they started from the northern provinces. And Taliban had never been any influence in the north. But because of the people frustration over the war, they forced their officials in different provinces to hand over the provinces to the Taliban. So Taliban started from the north. They took control of several provinces in the north. This encouraged the Taliban in the east, in the west, in the south to move forward because the army did not want to fight to fight more. The people were not willing that the war should be shifted to the cities from the villages. This was the main factors: political division, the morale of the Afghan forces, and the people pressure on the leadership that they don't want more war. So this paved the way for the Taliban to take control of Afghanistan.
Mr. Tahir Khan, there was another thing I wanted to ask. Was the U.S., when they left, the reason I used their swift withdrawal was because they left a lot of their equipment behind, which is like worth millions of dollars. What is the reason behind that?
I was in Kabul in July, in the last week of July, and I went to the defense ministry in Kabul, and I met some official there. I was told by one Taliban leader, defense official, Major General Abdul Latif Hakimi, who was previously the Taliban spokesman when there was a war in Afghanistan. He was telling me that the Americans destroyed many, many things, even the airfields and some infrastructure they have built. And even they tried to damage the tanks and everything, but they could not shift everything. They destroyed many things. So that's why the Taliban government now trying to repair some of the tanks, the helicopters, and other military vehicles. But the American could not take more weapons with them. So because they want to leave Afghanistan.
That's right, sir. Mr. Tahir Khan, the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan led to serious human rights violations by the NATO troops. Now, the perpetrators of the war crimes are still free. Why have the world organizations have been silent over this?
Now, this is a very good question. I would say the double standard of the Western countries, the double standard of the international, some organizations like International Court of Justice, War Criminal Courts, if people were killed in Afghanistan, there were strikes on the wedding ceremonies in Afghanistan, many civilians were killed. So in, they say this is not a human virus. And the Guantanamo is, Guantanamo was for everyone, because you may have heard from the prisoner who spent time in Guantanamo, because I met several the Guantanamo former prisoners. They faced a lot of problems there. So this is the double standard. I would say very briefly that the West, the Americans, the other Western European countries, they have a double standard. For them, human rights is issue is when it favors them. And for in other countries like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like Syria, when people are killed by the Americans or other countries. So for the Americans and the NATO and the European, this is not. So I would say this is double standard. And we still face this approach by the U.S. and the Western allies.
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Despite claims,
please.
I want to talk about the opium trade. Despite claims to curtail opium trade, the production of opium remained high during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. So my question would be, how did the United States benefit from the drug trade?
This is very simple. If I don't stop the poppy production, poppy opium cultivation, and then they knew, because the Taliban, the American forces were everywhere. I myself visited Helmand, which was the main provinces for these opium production. And believe me, I have seen on the main roads, huge fields of this opium production, the cultivation of the opium poppy. The problem is, they were, you are right. They were not. They could stop this cultivation of this opium and this drug, but they did not. So, because there was a war, and they were the control of those areas, but they did not stop them. So it means if you don't stop poppy cultivation or narcotic smuggling, it means you have benefit of all this. And this war, this American war in Afghanistan, the NATO war in Afghanistan. Every time you can, if you go to the media in the past, the Americans' factories of the weapons, some Western interests, they were involved in that war, because it was the war was run in Afghanistan by the American Western interests. So the opium production, I think they would be definitely benefiting them if they did not stop those poppy cultivation. And the problem is, Americans have left. Americans have gone. They were, I would say, they were defeated. But they left the weapons problem for the neighboring countries, for Afghans, the opium issue. So now Iran, Pakistan, Central Asia, they are facing multiple problems because of the war in Afghanistan. And the Americans are now safe in Washington and New York, and we are facing the problem.
So if you could just shortly tell me, how has the government now contain the opium problem?
I think they had, I would say, I would not say 100% control, because you know that the Taliban also, they knew that if there is no alternative to the opium, so although their leader, the Amir, has already banned this, and in many areas, in Helmand and other areas which was traditionally the poppy cultivation areas, I have also heard from many people that now this is not very easy for the very traditional poppy, the people who are involved in the cultivation, in the business. So to some extent, I would say it has been controlled. But I would not say that fully the Taliban have controlled this, because Taliban also know that if you totally ban these things, so maybe the people would suffer, and the people who are depending on this. And the second thing is the international community, especially the West, who brought the war to Afghanistan, they are not very interested to help the common people. Because when I was in Helmand last year, the local people were telling me that they were forced to stop the cultivation, but they were complaining that they were not given the alternative. So the Americans, the European, and the NATO, they should help those people who were forced to stop this cultivation of the poppy.
They had 20 years to do this. Mr. Taher Khan, thank you for being with
Welcome.
Us, sir.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. There you have it, political analyst and journalist Mr. Taher Khan from Islamabad. Glad to have him on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Izzat Ghafouri, a journalist, tweeted, "My pen is unable to write their pain. The crimes of America and England in Afghanistan are unforgivable. This young man was 10 years old when his father, mother, and three sisters and three little brothers were bombed and dismembered." Nar Edley, founder and director of Mint Press News, wrote, "In 2016, when the US military dropped bombs on Doctors Without Borders Trauma Hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, killing over 40 people and injuring hundreds more, The Pentagon investigated itself and concluded it didn't commit war crimes. Asif Durrani, Pakistan's special representative on Afghanistan, tweeted, "Being the champion of human rights, the U.S. should voluntarily submit its record of human rights violations in Afghanistan and Iraq, where approximately 900,000 people got killed. At the same time, Guantanamo Bay concentration camp is still operative." Maliha Hashmi, a journalist, UN consultant and trainer, tweeted, "The US, UK and Australia and other countries must be held accountable for human rights violations by their military in Afghanistan." Chen Zhu, China's UN envoy, tells Human Rights Council. Alex Rubenstein, an independent journalist, posted, "Eagerly awaiting a Pandora Papers-style info dump explaining where the money from Afghanistan's opium trade is sitting. Afghanistan went from having 7,606 hectares used for poppy cultivation in 2001 to 328,000 hectares in 2017. According to U.S. military, a 4,212% plus increase since invasion."
And that was our episode on 2 years since the humiliating U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The mugshot of former U.S. President Donald Trump was made public shortly after he left a jail in Fulton County, Georgia. His former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and others have also surrendered. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump surrendered on Thursday, 24th of August, at the Fulton County Jail, where he was booked on 13 felony counts related to an alleged scheme to overturn the results of the presidential election in Georgia in 2020. His surrender in Georgia marks the fourth time this year the former president has turned himself in after criminal charges were brought against him by federal and state officials. But it's the first time he was subjected to a mugshot. It's also routine for defendants in Fulton County, Georgia, to be fingerprinted and have their eyes scanned for biometric identification. Within an hour after he boarded his plane to leave Atlanta, Donald Trump's Save America PAC sent a fundraising email featuring his booking photo on a T-shirt. Trump also posted the mugshot on his X account, formerly known as Twitter, as well as to Truth Social, both posts with the words "election interference" and "never surrender." It marked Trump's first tweet since 8th of January 2021. 2 days after the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The booking process was quick, just about 30 minutes, since Trump's attorneys and prosecutors had agreed earlier this week to a $200,000 bond. The conditions of the agreement in part prohibit Donald Trump from intimidating his co-defendants, witnesses or alleged victims in the case, including on the social media platforms. Inmate records from the Fulton County Sheriff's Office list Donald Trump as 6 feet 3 inches tall and 215 pounds in weight. His hair color is described as blonde or strawberry and his eyes blue. Before he boarded his plane back to New Jersey, the former president told reporters that he and his co-defendants did nothing wrong and said it was a very sad day for America. "You should be able to challenge an election," he said. "I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election, and I should have every right to do that." Ahead of his surrender, Trump made changes to his legal team, bringing in Stephen Seddo, an Atlanta lawyer who specializes in white-collar and high-profile defense. Stephen Seddo entered his appearance as lead counsel for Trump on Thursday, according to a filing with the Fulton County Superior Court, and accompanied Donald Trump to jail. ABC News was first to report the change. Stephen Seddo is expected to replace Drew Feindling, the lead attorney on Trump's defense team. Feindling did not return a request for comment. Trump, who has denied any wrongdoing, did not appear in court on Thursday to enter a plea because the booking and arraignment processes are separate in Fulton County, Georgia. It's unclear when Trump will appear before a judge to be arraigned. District Attorney Fannie Willis has proposed Trump and his 18 co-defendants be arraigned the week on 5th of September, but the judge has not yet approved that request. Trump was working with a local bonding company to cover his $200,000 bond. Charles Shaw, the chief executive officer of Foster Bail Bonds LLC in Lawrenceville, Georgia, assisted Donald Trump in covering the cost of the bond. Defendants only need to put up 10% of the bail amount, $20,000 in this case for former President Trump, and the company will be paid a fee for posting the bond. The arrangements were made remotely earlier this week, Foster Bail Bonds confirmed. CNN was the first to report that Donald Trump is using a bail bond company. CNN, cable news network, has also covered the same story. Donald Trump surrendered on Thursday, 24th of August, at the Fulton County Jail on more than a dozen charges stemming from his efforts to reverse Georgia's 2020 election results. The fourth time this year, the former president has faced criminal charges. Trump spent a little more than 20 minutes at the Fulton County Jail, where he was processed and released on bond. Jail records showed him at 6 foot 3 inches tall and weighing 215 pounds with blue eyes and blonde or strawberry hair. His booking number was PO1135809. A mugshot of Donald Trump was released soon after he left the jail. Trump's surrender in Georgia marks the fourth time this year the former president has turned himself in to local or federal officials after criminal charges were brought against him. Episodes that had never been seen in the U.S. before 2023. The scene of Trump traveling to be arrested while denouncing the charges against him as politically motivated repeated itself again on Thursday, 24th of August, but that still didn't shake the remarkable and unprecedented scene of a former president and a leading GOP candidate for the White House in 2024 facing a criminal indictment. Trump called being at the jail a terrible and very sad experience in an interview later on Thursday with Newsmax. He said, "In my whole life I didn't know anything about indictments and now I've been indicted four times." In April, Trump was booked in New York on state charges related to a hush money scheme. In June, he surrendered at a Miami, Florida federal courthouse to face charges in special counsel Jack Smith probe into his mishandling of classified documents. And earlier this month, Donald Trump was placed under arrest in Washington, D.C. and arraigned on charges brought by special counsel Jack Smith in his investigation into attempts to overturn the 2020 election. All of those cases could come to a head next year at the same time that Trump is running for president. Like most of his 18 co-defendants in the sprawling racketeering case, who have already surrendered at the jail, Donald Trump was quickly processed through the facility because the former president and his lawyers have already negotiated his consent bond agreement. Trump agreed to a $200,000 bond and other release conditions, including not using social media to target the co-defendants and witnesses in this case. Trump covered the cost of his $200,000 bond by putting up 10% towards it and working with a local Atlanta bonding company called Foster Bell Bonds LLC, according to sources. Trump departed his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club for Georgia on Thursday afternoon, touching down in Atlanta, Georgia on his private plane in the evening. NBC News has also covered the same story. Donald Trump turned himself in for arrest at the Fulton County Jail on Thursday evening on felony charges in connection with efforts to overturn Georgia's 2020 presidential election results. He quickly became the biggest thing on social media with the release of his historic mugshot. Although he's been indicted four times this year, the Georgia case is the first time with a booking photo. While plenty of Trump's critics were eagerly awaiting the mugshot, Trump and his presidential campaign decided to embrace the notoriety as well. He returned to his one-time favorite social media platform, Twitter, which is now known as X, for the first time since he was kicked off it in January of 2021. Trump posted his mugshot, a link to his website, and the words, "Election interference and never surrender." His campaign quickly started selling mugshot T-shirts, and Trump senior advisor Chris Lacivita tweeted a warning to any scammers who might try to raise money off the photograph. "We are coming after you," he wrote, adding, "You will not scam donors." He's defiant, an aide traveling with Donald Trump said of the former president's mood on Thursday night.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we try to answer your questions and queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is an Islamic scholar and a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, Qom, Iran. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Well, Professor, how can we help our teens in identity formation and understanding cultural diversities?
Yes, this is a very important thing, especially if adults also understand what this means and implies.
Right.
We should be proud of ourselves as Muslims, as
True.
faithful followers of Islam and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. We should take pride in the fact that we are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. We should take pride in the fact that we have so beautiful personalities in the form of the infallible Imams, the Ahlul Bayt, Bibi Fatima, salamullah alayha, and they are our models, role models for us.
Right.
Of course, I don't mean that we say, as we normally say, Imam Ali is the first Shia Imam. No, he is the Imam of the world. He's the Imam of the whole of humanity.
Right.
But we accept him as our Imam, and we follow him, therefore we take pride in this. We have the honor to have accepted him to be the Imam after the Holy Prophet of Islam. So
right.
This identification with the Ahlul Bayt and Islam as a religion, this should be our cultural identity. We should not say we are first and foremost anything after being human beings, we are Muslims.
Right.
And we are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt and Islam. After that, we become Pakistanis, Iranians, Indians, or Iraqis.
We have the borders after that,
so
right.
Borders. So the first bonding is in humanity. The second bonding is in Islam and our religion. And the third is our faith, specifically our relation to Allah, to the Holy, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Right.
So this identity is our cultural identity. After that, any other identity comes. Yes, it's no wrong to say, there's no wrong in saying, look, I'm Muslim, but also I come from India, I come from Pakistan, I come from Iraq, I come from Iran, I come
right.
from maybe someone says I'm from Britain, I'm from America, but still the basic ingredient is Islam. So we need to make them understand, our children should know that we are first and foremost Muslims and mu'min people, and therefore our perspective is common. Our perspective is that we have a common goal. We have a common identity. We have a common goal. And we, all of us, want ourselves to become the soldiers of the awaited Imam. And we are those who are working for the sake of the advent of the Imam. We are all working for this purpose together.
Sometimes when parents are dealing with their children and they want them to be accepted in the society in a very better way, they forget the fact that identity is something that comes, that emerges from within. And they kind of try to tell their children that you got to be, fabricating this thing. So don't you think identity issues come over here?
They need to be able to reflect upon themselves and their thoughts and their feelings. The children should be able to carry out introspection and feel, understand what they are from within.
Right.
And then they have to see if it what they stand for, what they are from within. Is it according to what they stand for as Muslims? Are they able to internalize those concepts and those feelings that are associated with being a Muslim, and their practice should not conflict with that. So if there's a problem, yes, internally they're not able to adjust themselves to that belief system or that system of morals and principles, values, and in practice they feel difficulties, there will certainly be a conflict, because in many societies when we are living, even our parents do carry out things which do not comply with the standards which should be there.
Right. Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. We'll be back in a while.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're discussing about the importance of identity formation and cultural diversities when it comes to Islamic upbringing of our children. Well, Professor, you know, sometimes when our children are, you know, they are lost in their own world, especially when they are teens. So they're going through a hell lot of thoughts and, you know, maybe sometimes discovering themselves or maybe having this identity formation issues. So because the journey towards identity passes through a landscape of self-discovery. So how can parents help their children with self-discovery so that they don't have this identity formation issue?
So they should be able to discuss openly these issues with their parents. The parents should themselves have gone through this stage, and they have developed their identity according to what the Islam or the religion they follow says. So if they have been able to develop that, then they can engage with their children, discuss with them, and they can discuss with them the concepts and the beliefs that they hold and they want their children to conform with. So they should be openly discussing with them. Or if they're not able to do so, then they should attach themselves to groups of parents or children where they can interact together and discuss about these issues and expose their children to various discussion forums where they can, or different cultural events, where they can make their children realize that despite all the differences that we may have as far as our cultures go, somebody is from some background, somebody is from another background, as far as culture, as far as clothing goes, as far as eating food goes, as far as maybe the way we live goes, but the core things that Islam stands for, they are common between all of us.
Right.
I mean, when we talk about Islam as a religion, which is for all of mankind,
right.
Islam is not addressing, it's not talking about these superficial things. Islam is talking about the basic core principles of life, the
right.
core values, and they're common for all of mankind.
Right.
So the different attires, costumes, apparent features, they may differ. Even, for example, various tribes, various races have different colors, different maybe facial features. Even difference in physique. So many differences are there in the human race.
Right.
But there's one common thing, thing which is inherent in all mankind.
Right.
The very nature of mankind is common. Islam addresses that commonality.
True.
So we can make our children understand and ourselves understand, look, there's one thing common between human beings. And this
matter their race, color, diversity.
Color, whatever, language, background, whatever may be there.
Right.
They're human beings. For example, a human being's gender interaction, human beings as male and female, everything is common between all mankind.
Right.
I mean, when it comes to maybe relationships with parents, relationship with children, there are so many things common for all.
Right.
Just as when we talk about medical issues.
Right.
I mean, when you talk about for a heart surgery.
Right.
The heart is similar for all human beings.
Right. Professor, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a while.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. We are with Professor Salman Akavi, and we're discussing about the identity formation and cultural diversities in children when it comes to Islamic upbringing. Professor, early in the morning today, I had a discussion with my father-in-law, and he was saying that just a few days ago, I was writing on a paper about you, about your sister-in-law, about your husband, about another, you know, daughter-in-law, and about all the, you know, children in the family. He was writing, and he said that I was writing your goods and bads. But then I tore off this paper because I didn't want any Because I just thought with myself, if any one of you sees this, you'll get hurt. So I tore it off. And then I read this hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam for him. I told him, you should have not torn it. You should not have, you know, torn it off. You should have remembered that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Man arafa nafsahu faqad arafa rabba." The one who knows himself knows his Lord. And maybe you could have helped us with that paper. You could have helped us understand what are our goods, what are our bads, which maybe we ourselves don't know. So don't you think parents, with the fear of that their children don't get hurt, you know, don't let them have a better understanding of their self. They don't. They lack in this help of self-discovery, which could help in their identity formation.
Yes, very rightly so, that we need to make our children realize the fact that, yes, we as human beings have something common. There's elements which are there in all human beings. What are those elements? We need to understand them.
Right.
The cognition that Allah has given us, the intellect that Allah has given us, the soul, the center of emotions and feelings.
Right.
Every human being has them. How to develop them, how to make them, how to understand things, the truth in itself. How is it to be discovered? This is common.
Right.
So we need to, our children, to focus on these basic core ingredients of a human being.
Right.
And to make them realize that this is what Islam wants to take care of. Islam wants us to take care of these core things. When it comes to other superficial things, it doesn't matter. We may belong to any culture.
Exactly.
I mean, we shouldn't be trying to imitate others.
Right.
There's no need to imitate other cultures.
Be yourself.
Be yourself. How you clothe yourself, it should be modest. Islam says your covering should be modest. Now, whatever type of covering you have, it belongs to your culture.
Right.
If you're from the subcontinent, there's a certain type of covering.
Right.
If you're from the West, there's another type of covering. If you're from the East, there's another type of covering. Covering, the way, the color, how you make the clothes, how the food you are making, they're all different. The common things, it should be halal food, it should be...
The food should be halal, the clothing should be
nutritious,
modest.
It should be... So there are common things which are there, which are common to all. That is the core identity which we all should have as human beings, as Muslims. And then we have the superficial things. That, following any culture, doesn't make any... That's not problematic. We can... You know, bring them in harmony, bring them together in harmony. For example, we go for majalis, we go for azadari, we go for remembering the martyrdom of and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein. Everyone does it in his own way, in his own culture.
Yeah.
And till it does not cross some red lines, it's within the limits, within the bounds, it can be performed in any way.
Right.
It should just make us remember that the sacrifice of Imam Hussein and remember his mission and make us wanting to carry that mission out.
Right.
So these are the core things that we make our identity.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and helping us with that beautiful discussion. Dear listeners, your identity is not found in possessions, people, or fame that we wrongly sometimes teach our children. It's something that is found in God. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet.
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.